Things have moved on in the last 5 years. You now have MP3 players, your own website and things like that. For those who don't know me or my family, my name's Joshua Peppel. We used to attend here coming up 5 years ago now. My wife, Elisa, is in Cambodia. We've been in Cambodia for the last 2 years, where I work for World Vision. We have one son, Samuel, and my wife's pregnant. We're expecting our second child. In some ways, I know that I'm returning home by the level of preparation that I do for a presentation. Usually, being a recovering control freak, as the princess would like to probably describe me, I have prepared very little. So this morning I'll be sharing more about what we've been doing over the last 2 years and some of the good things that God's been doing in us as a family, and also some of the work that I've been involved with. No worries. It was a bee. It was the bee.
Try the other one. Yeah, the bee was fine. just hang on a second.
Oh, I'll do this. There we go. So they say never work with kids or electronics, and I have my son here and I'm working with electronics, so for those who are PowerPoint literate, please. Trying to start it.
Are you pressing the right mood end?
I'll let you. Do you mind pressing it?
Yeah.
Anyway.
You've got two. You've done the twin screen thing.
Inshallah, God only knows what I've done. Anyway, why don't I get started? And we can keep it at this, or we can kind of move on. So what we'll do this morning is just give you a bit of an update on the Peppel family, what we've been doing for the last 2 years. My wife, Elisa, has been working on a PhD for the last, I think, a year and a half. She sends her love, and she does have a few little key points that we've put here on a PowerPoint screen if we get that going. But she's well, she's pregnant, she's due in June, so we'll be back here in Perth. She'll be back probably around mid-May, and I'll be coming back in June for that. Her research is looking at the needs of humanitarian aid worker families. Sadly, the demands on... Here we go. Well, there we go. So Elisa sends her love. She's grateful that she's been blessed with good health and friendship in Phnom Penh. Cambodia's been a wonderful posting for us as a family. It's a really easy kind of place to live. We, after having worked for 3 years in Sri Lanka in quite a demanding role, Cambodia's been a real place for healing for us. She's slowly plodding through her PhD. She got a scholarship through Curtin, which is great, and she's just started doing interviews for her research. I guess in the last 10 years, being based in the field, we've seen many relationships end. A lot of our close friends have separated. Just some of it had to do with the demands of the work, but a lot of it had to do with who they were as people and what they brought to the environment. So out of that, I think for both of us, but especially for Elisa, she realised there was a real need to improve how we support families of aid workers, especially not just in conflict zones, but also in development. So her research is looking at family resilience. What is it that an organisation can do to try to improve the resilience of a family? So she's working on that. She's missing myself and Sam, which was good. She put that up there. I didn't include that myself. she hasn't been apart from Sam, so she's finding that transition a little bit tough. naturally. And she's looking forward to seeing everyone here in a few months' time. The pregnancy is going well, but we would really appreciate your prayers. The healthcare services in Cambodia are not the best. So if there's any medical treatment that's required, we need to be medevaced across to Bangkok. So that's where we fly for most of our medical treatment. Sam, he's at the back there. He's been a delight. Parenthood has been fantastic. It really has been. It's been quite a transition, though, from us, especially for me, I guess, having worked mostly in conflict zones, to, you know, having a small family unit to think of, and I can't rush off to Haiti or Sudan or places like that. But that's actually been a very good thing. Sam settled into Cambodia fantastically. He understands as much Khmer as he does English. His current loves are Maisie tuk-tuks. He loves planes. He has his own frequent flyer card, so he gets to travel quite a bit. Here he is on his bike, so he gets around Phnom Penh on the front of his bike, and he kind of thinks it's his little carriage, so he kind of waves to people as he's passing, a bit like the Queen. And he's studying Gecko, which is kind of like a, I guess, Wiggly Woo's equivalent in Phnom Penh. As I shared, before moving to Cambodia, we had spent 3 years in Sri Lanka, where I was as part of the leadership team working on the tsunami response and then responding to the north. And that was a really challenging time for us. And when I arrived back in Cambodia, some people found it a bit ironic that I went to work in human trafficking to recover. But in some ways, it's indicative of the level of stress and pressure of the last 3 years in Sri Lanka, and before that in Iraq and the Middle East and things like that. So when we arrived in Cambodia, I was pretty much gutted. I was fairly burnt out emotionally, spiritually, physically. The kind of work that I'd been doing and the decisions that I had to make were often life or death. And I know I've shared when we came back 2 years ago, like I would wake up in the morning and work out where the shelling ranges were and make a decision on that morning if I had to move my office because the team were trapped in the northern part of Sri Lanka. And yeah, there was all these different kind of tensions which some of these photos represent, you know, like I was making the transition to becoming a father and wanting to be a good husband. It was a parallel universe. I was in a refugee camp with 300,000 people who were trapped, being shelled, and then I'd get in a car and drive down to the south of Colombo and be sitting on this place called the Goldface Hotel, 5-star hotel, having a beer, watching the sun go down. So it was schizophrenic. And then overwhelming need. Sri Lanka at that time was one of the most dangerous places to be an aid worker. We were averaging 2 aid workers killed a day, a month from about the last 12 months of the war. It was actually more dangerous than Sudan, but no one knew it, which was difficult. And just the complexity. So I was kind of struggling with all these things, and it just took its toll. So funny enough, I've kind of found a bit of recovery in a trauma recovery project. So from going from a very big kind of relief project, I started work with World Vision on a small specialised anti-human trafficking project. And I thought what I'd do this morning is to share a little bit about what I've been doing and the situation in Cambodia in regards to trafficking. I know Paul's been to Cambodia and what he saw inspired a few songs. Was that the one that we sung just then? Okay, it's all kind of a mix. But yeah, look, Cambodia is a relatively young country. Majority of its population are in kind of that teenage to early 20s. 35% of the population still live below the poverty line. There's uneven economic development. A lot of money has come into Cambodia. There's a lot of manufacturing, especially around clothing manufacturing. I think the salary now for a clothing worker who works 7 days a week is about $65 a month. So that's not a week, sorry, a month. And in terms of trafficking, it's a massive issue. A lot of it started with UNTAC, where the UN came in, with the United Nations Transitional Government. People saw it was a massive influx. There was about 25,000 UN personnel, and obviously the economic differences between UN workers and local people were significant, and that kind of started massive prostitution rings, pedophile rings and things like that. So you don't often think about some of the negative aspects of the UN coming in, but this was definitely one of them, and the research kind of that is around kind of backs that up. That being said, there's always been trafficking in Cambodia, there's always been a sex industry. It just kind of is a bit like putting a match to a thing of gasoline. It just went up. So Cambodia is on a tier 2 watch list, which means that they're making some improvements around human trafficking, but they still need to do a lot of work. But the situation is pretty grim. So the project I've been working with is called Nivit Tamai, and it's the Trauma Recovery Project. It's been going for about 10 years. We work with young girls aged from 4 to 18 years who have been freed from brothels. And I've got a video that will go for about 10 minutes and it will explain better than I can the current trafficking system or the processes in Cambodia and its effect. We focus on three kind of areas. We have a residential facility where at the moment there's about 25 girls. We also work on the clinical component. So a lot of my work over the last 2 years has been about setting up good social work case management systems, setting up good clinical services. We've rolled out a new clinical model, a trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy with Johns Hopkins University, which has been very successful. And then the other side, which I've kind of enjoyed the most, is more the prosecution side. So we pushed our prosecution rates up to about 72%. Last year we were in court 362 times, representing children and their families in the prosecution of both national and foreign sex offenders. We successfully prosecuted 8 foreign pedophiles, and one of them, but I was in the States November of last year. We took a victim back to America to give evidence in court, and his name was Michael Dodd. And he was prosecuted, and he's currently serving 10 years, not doing too well in prison, which I can't say I have much sympathy for him. But so we worked with the FBI and Interpol in collecting all the information to make sure that prosecution went ahead. Tragically, Michael Dodd, though, had abused children in Panama and was able to pay his way out, came to Cambodia as an English teacher, was employed by one of the big expatriate schools there, who hadn't even done a police check. And because the way the Interpol is kind of set up, when he arrived in Cambodia, was red flagged with the FBI that have quite a large mission in the embassy there. And they kind of, they weren't supposed to, but they contacted the school and said, look, do you realise that you've employed this person? Tragically, they wouldn't kick him out of the country. So what's happened in Cambodia is that as places in Thailand and not so much Laos, but more Thailand and the Philippines have started to tighten up on the trafficking of children, a lot of the sex offenders now are focusing on Cambodia because it's so easy. Even if you're caught, for about $6,000, you can get any outcome that you want. And the judges make the real money, not on the initial prosecution, but on the appeal. For Michael Dodd, unfortunately, he spent all of his money, unfortunately for him, fortunately for us, he spent all his money on the initial prosecution and then when it came to the appeal, but he was really fighting to kind of get out. So it was kind of horrific. We had attempted kidnappings, we had people, unknown masked gunmen, try to find the child, threats, intimidation, so... in some ways the work has been very similar to Relief, but it hasn't been as intense as Sri Lanka, so it's been interesting. But a lot of my role was to work with the project as a technical advisor to improve all of these three elements. And in the last 2 years it's been very successful, and we've gone through an organisational change process where there's been a lot of improvements in this program. So they now have secure funding for the next 4 years, and I've just accepted a new role with World Vision UK, focusing on humanitarian accountability, which I'll explain a little bit more later on. This is this one is pretty funny. I got known as World Inquisition. This was by a French pedophile that thought it was a good idea to. He was very angry about our support of the family and the children, and that we were very aggressively pursuing legal action against him. So he thought it would be good while he was in prison to come up with a comic book and to sell it. Unfortunately for him, we used that in court against him, so we got known as World Inquisition. And I like to think that we pursued him with the same fervour. Before I show the video, kind of the ugly reality about human trafficking is that unlike drugs or the sale of arms that you use once, a human you can use over and over and over again. It's the second most lucrative illegal industry in the world, the first being drugs, and it's actually behind human arms. It is a massive, massive problem on a global scale, and it is worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. And the way that traffickers work is they use the same kind of systems that they use to move drugs and illegal arms, those same kind of networks, those logistics, supply chain management, they use to move humans. Yeah. And Cambodian children are trafficked from everywhere, from to London, Paris, to the United States, even to Australia. Yeah. And we're just not aware of it. And we don't know, I don't think anyone really has a grasp on how big the industry is and where these children kind of go. And in Cambodian culture, it's seen as okay for a wealthy Cambodian from Phnom Penh to go into the provinces and actually buy a child, come in and work as essentially as a servant. So in their house, do the cleaning and things like that. And the going rates anywhere between $100 to $250. So what happens is that, you know, offenders then use that. And that's those children are then channeled into this massive trafficking network and literally exported around the world. But, you know, a lot of the attention is on foreigners who come into Cambodia, but the majority of abuse is done by Cambodians. So Cambodians abusing Cambodian children. And in some ways it's easier for Cambodia to focus the attention on foreigners because it takes the attention off what their own people are doing to their own children. So this is just a little map of the trafficking of persons in Southeast Asia. As you can see, it's huge. There's almost a country that isn't touched, where a child hasn't ended up, or a young woman hasn't been trafficked to. This is starting up. So this was called The Virginity Trade and was put together by a French film crew. There's two DVDs and they're both excellent. But it goes for about 10 minutes and it kind of explains a bit about the Khmer Rouge, the genocide, and how Cambodians perceive trafficking. And at the end of that, I'll just do a quick summary of what's happening for us in the next 12 months. And then I'm happy to try to answer any questions that you might have. So, for those who may be a little bit queasy, there are some quite graphic images from Tol Sleng, which was the prison camp where many, many Cambodians died. So just to make you aware of that, you might just want to look away. I'll just stop it there. Okay. And they're excellent videos. Maybe what I can do is, if someone would be happy to copy them, I'd be happy to leave two of my copies and then I can get them back. This goes on for about another hour and it explores the life of three girls whose virginity was sold. And initially, What will happen is that there will be a broker, they'll go to a village, the family will sell their daughter, the person will use that child or that young lady for a few weeks, and then they are then sold back, they're sold again onto a brothel. And then the amount of money that they can earn can be quite high because they haven't seen many clients. And then it gradually goes down and down and down and down. And so the images that you saw there are pretty much at the bottom of the barrel. And between the bottom of the brothels and the top, there's different layers. Until eventually, for most of these women, have very, you know, most of them have HIV. They're self-harming. You probably saw the scars on her arm where she cuts herself. All of them, the young girls that we've worked with, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, incredible high levels of depression, self-harming, experiences with drug abuse. And the centre that I've been working with has been trying to help those young girls recover. So they will stay in our shelter for anything from 12 months to 2 years. So we'll help them on the prosecution side, but a lot of our time and effort is on the recovery side, and it's an incredibly complex and difficult, and it's a long journey. But it's been kind of a wonderful experience for me to return back to kind of social work, and it's been very interesting. So, if people are interested, I'm happy to leave those videos. And the other one is the Girls of Phnom Penh, which is made by the same company that put this together. And it looks at more kind of a macro view of trafficking, not only in Cambodia, but also in the region. So just prayer points for us. I've just signed on for another contract with World Vision UK, but I'll be based in Cambodia. And as many of you know, part of the reason that I've taken a less stressful role in anti-human trafficking was to go back to school. So I'm just about to finish my MBA. I'm in my final two units, and the reason I'm here is for an intensive. The pregnancy, it would be great to have your prayers for that. At least we'll be returning to Perth around mid-May. I'll be returning in roughly around the first week of June. I guess for health, you know, it took us a little while. It took me especially a while to recover from Sri Lanka. And just for physical, relational health, physical, spiritual and emotional health. Elisa and her PhD, she continues with that. Sam, he's starting Gecko, but there's a bit of a transition with a new baby coming into our family, so prayers would be appreciated for that. And for myself, there's a lot more, there is more travel involved in my new role, so I'm taking on a role of humanitarian accountability. And I was talking to Paul about it earlier on this morning, and it's about trying to improve the effectiveness of what we do. So World Vision is a very large organisation, but not just World Vision, across the sector. In my view, we should be the most professional, well-run, well-managed organisation, because if we're not, then the lives of children and communities are affected. If we don't have good financial management systems in place, if we're inefficient in the way that we procure products for humanitarian responses, it means that people will go without clean water, without clean food, without good food, and things like that. So part of the reason was returning to do business was I kind of realised that, you know, I had degrees in social work and development, which was fantastic, but I was, you know, managing anywhere between $15 to $20 million projects. So I needed to get reskilled in things like finance, in human resource management and things like that, and it's been wonderful. I'll be covering a number of countries. One of them is Zimbabwe, Uganda and Cambodia, just to roll out some pilots. To try to improve downward accountability to communities, so keeping our promises to communities, but also upward accountability. So that'll see me on the road about 15%. So I'd appreciate your prayers for Elisa and Sam, and just for safety as well, because we're moving out of an apartment into a house. So while I'm away, and yeah, look, Cambodia is a fairly safe place, but I guess, yeah, leaving them behind, there's a bit of anxiety there for me, so just for safety and things like that. So that's kind of us in a nutshell. thank you for your prayers. We still feel connected to Mount Hawthorn. It's great to get your newsletter in my inbox and to see that we're still mentioned there. This is our home. Perth is our home. This is our church. We will return to this at some point. But we just want to say thank you for all the prayers and the thoughtfulness and the emails from different people here. We really, really appreciate it. So thank you. And I think, you know, if anyone has any questions, happy to try to answer them. Otherwise, we can move on to coffee. Yeah, whatever people like. Yeah. Sam's asking for a big ball. So a big ball for Sam.
There it is.
I think first of all, just pray for us. You know, pray for those for our relationship. At least, and our relationship is really strong, but we don't take that for granted. For health, we've been quite blessed so that neither of us have been sick. In terms of kind of the work that we do, I guess, just for wisdom. But you can also, World Vision runs a lot of tracking programs in the region. So if you go onto World Vision Australia's website and type in, we have a link there for trafficking. World Vision Australia actually fund the project that I've been working with, the clinical component. So if you feel that you want to give, that would be a great way to do that. Alternatively, if you wanted to fund a smaller organisation, I'd also be happy to provide some details of some excellent agencies who probably don't have the access to the money that World Vision does as well. So, I think just keep doing what you're doing. As you said, we feel connected and part of the community, but definitely prayer and things like that would be great.
Definitely appreciate the agency contacts.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The other thing is that Lisa also has a WordPress blog site called Snaps and Banter. Okay, so you can stay updated. She's great for keeping connected with people. I'm a little bit not that good. So if you go to, just type into Google Snaps and Banter and hit WordPress link, and that has heaps of photos and what we're doing and things like that. So if you want to stay connected. The other thing, I guess, is just try to be informed and educate yourself about trafficking. And I know that this church is committed to issues of social justice, and there's a lot of people here that support TIER and things like that. But yeah, it is, and it's only going to become a bigger issue in time, for sure. Yeah. And World Vision Australia has some great links for that.
When you're working in a very small project, do you feel that when you do things well, that has a flow-on effect?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think the people are crying out for good practice, and often, you know, my position has been a bit of a luxury position. You don't generally have an expat technical advisor for such a small project. So the way that it usually works is $1 million, one expat. So my budget is a lot less than that. But it was quite a technical area. So one of the things that been really encouraging for me, having gone from a big portfolio of projects like food, water security, all of that, just to focus, is that I've been able to apply a lot of the theory that I've been learning in my MBA around organisational change and come up with models that I've then been able to share with World Vision globally, and people have been able to leverage that learning. So yeah, it is. But it's attention, because I think the classic question I get when I work for World Vision is, if I give a dollar to World Vision, how much is going in admin? And people have associated reduced admin overheads with quality. And it doesn't work that way. Like, if you give a dollar to World Vision, our overheads, I think, are around 12 cents. But, you know, the drawback with that is that if you were willing to give a little bit more, say another 10 cents in the dollar or 12 cents in the dollar, then we could make sure that they had the technical capacity they need to make sure that the remaining 70 cents were spent really, really well. So what happened is, unfortunately, in the sector, is that people now give based on a breakdown, and it's not effective, you know. It's just not effective, which is something that we're looking at trying to change people's understanding of the money that they give. And a lot of that aid effectiveness is kind of trying to look at these issues, but old habits die hard, because I think we've marketed ourselves as, you know, keeping overheads down fairly low, and World Vision is probably in a fairly good position, but a lot of other agencies, and so there's a lot of competition out there, and people compete with one another for cutting costs, and usually those costs will be cut around technical and specialised assistance.
Just interested in the fact that a lot of the work that you're showing us that you're doing is that sort of banking to the cataclysmic stuff that happens. And they're talking a lot about the culture of acquiring people as being part of an old established company. What sort of work are you doing or partnering in or friends doing about the front end stuff, the presentation and that sort of cultural change? Or is it possible?
Yeah, look, good question, Ken. And you're right, changing the culture is by far the most difficult, and the value systems that drive, because you're right, we're really dealing with the back-end results. So just with the project that we work with, when a child returns to their village, we'll do a blessing ceremony, and we bring in Buddhist monks. And we do a blessing ceremony over their house, which they don't usually have. We'll build them the house, because they'll be in the office, the most poor of a poor community. And so we try to address that stigma, and then for 12 months after, we'll work with local government and the police to make sure it's monitored. But we'll also provide training, try to provide training to address some of those value systems. The other thing is we monitor it rigorously, because the risk of a child being re-trafficked, if they're being trafficked once, is like 70%. So, yeah, they're of very little value. And I think that the reason we've fought so hard with the foreign pedophiles that we've prosecuted and thrown heaps of money and time and resources at it, is because we wanted to make a statement on a global stage that if you come to Cambodia, if you prosecute... if you abuse a child, World Vision will throw everything it has. And guess what? We have 40,000 people. We work in 100 countries. Our budget is $4.2 billion, and we will go after you with everything we've got. And we pursued this guy, and we were just like a pit bull. We wouldn't let go, because we know that a message needed to be sent. And the way that the pedophile networks work in Cambodia is children are passed around the foreign pedophiles. And they all lend each other money and strategies to fight in Cambodia, because the last thing they want to do is be deported. So in that aspect, we knew that if we make a stand and we pursue vigorously, we appeal, if the outcome isn't fair and just, that we're sending that message. And then at the national level, we've been working for a number of years on passing through policy that protects the rights of children. And so in 2008, there was the first child protection policy focused purely on human trafficking. That means that children, there are certain things that the police have to do in terms of interview techniques, children have rights to have independent lawyers, all of those kind of things. So we try to work on the global and then the national and also the local stage. That being said, you know, it's still, as they said, you know, men are like gold, women are like cloth. And once a child has been abused, they have no value in that community. And that makes them susceptible to rape, targeting. And in some ways, Cambodia has like what I call a trauma imprint. No one talks about the Khmer Rouge. No, and they've only just started teaching about it in the schooling system in the last 12 months. And it was one of the worst genocides in history. You know, they killed more people per head of the population than the Nazis in the Second World War. You know, and yet it's not being taught in the school system, and so people don't believe it actually happened. So there's this big collective kind of denial. And then that kind of flows on to trafficking and the abuse of children, where people don't believe it's actually happening. It's those Westerners, and a lot of our marketing has been around with tuk-tuk drivers and hotel associations, that if you see a foreigner with a child, you contact us. And they're working really well. But people often are very resistant to putting those same marketing messages around educating people around, if you see a Khmer man, with a Khmer child coming to your hotel or your guest house, you contact us. And the other thing is, as was mentioned by the head of Licardo, is that in some ways the foreign pedophiles are easy to, because they stand out. The biggest things that we're trying to break into Malaysian, Taiwanese, Hong Kong Chinese, Singaporean, Japanese. They're much, much harder, and we don't know how those networks kind of operate, and you can't get into it unless you're Asian. So yeah, it's a big job, but a lot of work. But changing the cultural attitudes of Cambodians is probably the biggest challenge we're facing. But we're chipping away. Like, World Vision's been there now 25 years, so we're not going anywhere, and I think that continuity, we will get there in the end. And we have great national staff that we're really committed to this as well. The team I've been working with has just been absolutely fantastic. Yeah. All right, thank you, everyone.
Okay, I'm just going to ask Paul to come and pray for Josh and Lawrence.